From the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, I'm Barbara Caritti, bringing you the news on This Day in Maine, Thursday, October 8th, 2015. And on this day, Maine's opiate crisis is attacked anew, this time with a collaborative effort that's aiming for drastic reductions in drug trafficking and overdose deaths. Two new gambling initiatives are in the works that would authorize a casino in York County and another racino somewhere in southern Maine. And how boosting the arts helped lift the U.S. out of the Great Depression. That and more after this.
This Day in Maine is made possible in part by listeners like you and by Lee Auto Malls, serving Maine since 1936 and a proud supporter of MPBN Radio, with locations throughout the state and online at leeauto.com.
I'm Barbara Caritti. Less than 2 months after Senator Angus King and Governor Paul LePage held separate drug summits on Maine's opiate problem, a new multidimensional approach is underway to address the public health crisis. It's called the Maine Opiate Collaborative. The focus goes beyond law enforcement to include prevention and treatment. And as Susan Sharon reports, those leading the effort say they expect measurable outcomes.
Attorney General Janet Mills says she doesn't want another report dropped in the circular bin in the spring or summer of next year. She and others involved in the Maine Opiate Collaborative want action and results, including a drastic reduction in the number of drug traffickers in the state and a drastic reduction in heroin and drug overdose deaths. There were 208 last year.
I want to see a drastic increase in the prevention efforts in our schools. I want to see an increase in the public education efforts. I want to see families come forward and tell us very bluntly how their family members got addicted and how we can prevent this happening to other people.
Three independent working groups have been established to identify the issues that are fueling the opiate crisis and to come up with solutions. They could include everything from expanding drug courts and coordinating resources to proposing legislation at the state and federal levels. Gordon Smith, Executive Vice President of the Maine Medical Association, says a crucial underpinning of the effort is the recognition that substance abuse disorder, commonly known as addiction, is a chronic illness. That means patients will relapse and live with this illness the rest of their lives. But Smith says they shouldn't be discriminated against or stigmatized as a result.
We spend millions of dollars in this state to fix people's hearts. We might put a stent in an artery because a person has overeaten for 60 years. If that person then goes right back after their surgery to McDonald's, we don't have a guard out in front of McDonald's saying, "Oh no, Jack, you don't get a second chance. We're not going to do your next stent." And we shouldn't do that to people with substance use disorder.
Smith says there's no question that Maine needs more drug treatment. And he acknowledges there aren't a lot of resources. Methadone and Suboxone are the most effective treatments, Smith says, but there aren't enough Suboxone providers in Maine. Still, he says a comprehensive review of what Maine has and what works for people is needed. Public Safety Commissioner John Morris shares that view.
Despite the claims that police or law enforcement is only interested in arresting, we understand that there are three issues.
Those issues, says Morris, are law enforcement, education, and treatment. He says the goal for law enforcement is to go after drug dealers aggressively, but not to fill the county jails with drug users.
We're not interested in the users in the sense of arrest. We're interested in drug dealers who fully understand coming up here to Maine is to make a profit.
U.S. Attorney Tom Delahanty says the three working groups will hold public meetings over the next several months, and they will occasionally meet together. The effort is also expected to include a statewide summit sometime next year to report on outcomes. He says ever since the two drug summits in August, people from across the state have been coming forward and asking what they can do to help.
In 45 years of practicing law, mostly in some way related to criminal practice in the courts, I've never seen this large number of individuals come forward regardless of the issue.
Some will serve on the committees. Some will be asked to participate in other ways. We're not going to cure addiction, Delahanty said, but we're not going to stand around while these people poison our neighbors and friends. For MPBN News, I'm Susan Sharon.
We've been reporting that four of the mariners missing in the Alfaro sinking were Maine Maritime graduates. It turns out that a fifth member of the cargo ship's crew also graduated from the Castine School. Academy President William Brennan says Mitchell Kuflick graduated in the class of 2011 and was aboard the Alfaro when it sank last week in Hurricane Joaquin. The search for victims was called off yesterday. Investigators are still trying to determine the circumstances that led to the sinking. And victims of the Quebec rail disaster that destroyed downtown Lac-Mégantic and killed 48 people are closer to getting settlement payments. Canadian Pacific Railroad has withdrawn its objection to the $338 million settlement fund, removing the final obstacle to its approval, expected tomorrow. U.S. bankruptcy trustee Robert Keech says he hopes payments will be made to victims by the end of the year. Maine voters could face one of the busiest ballots ever next year if new gambling questions win the Secretary of State's approval. One would establish a casino in York County, and another would authorize a racino, that is, a slot machine parlor and harness racing track, somewhere in southern Maine. Both efforts are propelled by a developing gaming industry in Massachusetts and are being promoted as new tourism attractions for Maine. A.J. Higgins has more.
Lewiston Signature Gathering organizer Stavros Mendros isn't saying much about the casino effort, but he did confirm that he was approached by a group that wants to launch a citizens' initiative to establish a casino in York County.
You know, I own the largest petition company in the state, and they reached out to me and asked me to file the paperwork for them so they could get the ball rolling. So that's all I've done right now. I really can't. I don't know much more than that at this point, and I really can't say much more than that.
Maine Secretary of State Matt Dunlap says he has begun the process of reviewing the applications for Mendros' effort, as well as another for a racino slot machine parlor that would be operated by Scarborough Downs owner Sharon Terry.
We did get two applications yesterday for a casino in York County and an integrated racino in southern Maine. Two different organizations have submitted these, and what happens now is that we convey their draft legislation to the Office of the Reviser of Statutes.
According to the York County petition, the new casino would enhance tourism in southern Maine and prevent the state from losing gaming revenues to Massachusetts, where several new casinos are currently under consideration. The Scarborough Downs proposal cites similar reasons for expanding gambling, but envisions a facility that would include a harness racing track as part of the complex. Dunlap says the two applications bring the current number of ballot proposals for 2016 to 13, but both efforts will have to obtain just over 61,000 signatures to qualify for the ballot by February 1st.
I'm not real hopeful that we're going to see gambling initiatives on the 2016 ballot, just because there's a lot of work that has to be done before we get that far.
Last year, a report commissioned by the legislature determined there was capacity for additional casino gambling in Maine and recommended the southern region of the state as the best location for a new gaming facility. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
The woman accused of stabbing and killing a victim at random in a Saco supermarket pleaded guilty to murder in York County Superior Court this afternoon. As Patty White reports, Connor McAllister is requesting a life sentence.
McAllister's attorney, Robert LeBrasser, says his client accepts full responsibility for her actions.
You have someone who is trying to do the right thing for her own reasons as well as to make it better for the victim's family.
On the afternoon of August 19th, 31-year-old Connor McAllister followed 59-year-old Wendy Boudreau into the Shaw supermarket in Saco to the ice cream aisle, where she then stabbed her in the neck and face. According to court documents, McAllister planned the attack for a month and targeted an elderly woman who wouldn't resist. McAllister later told police she was off her medication, was angry at life, and wanted to get back at someone. Prior to the court hearing Thursday, McAllister had several competency evaluations. The prosecutor in the case, Assistant Attorney General Leanne Zania, says McAllister's guilty plea is unique.
Clearly, by pleading guilty so early in the process, a family doesn't have to undergo a long, protracted period of anticipation for a trial and then the trial itself.
McAllister, who has identified as a transgender male, asked the court to refer to her as a female. She's requesting a life sentence. Her attorney says he must argue for what his client wants. The prosecutor says she'll review the case before making a recommendation for the sentencing on November 23rd. For MPBN News, I'm Patty White.
Coming up, lifting America out of depression by funding the arts. Maine Senator Angus King is proposing what he calls common sense measures aimed at curbing gun violence. On the Senate floor this afternoon, King proposed to close loopholes that allow people to buy guns without passing a background check. King told colleagues that convicted felons and those who have demonstrated dangerous mental illness should be disqualified from having a firearm. King is also proposing to make so-called straw purchasing, in which one person buys a gun for someone else who is not legally allowed to have one, and gun trafficking, federal crimes. A program that helps Mainers in six rural counties with housing will get almost $800,000 in funding from the USDA. Community Concepts Mutual Self-Help Housing Program finds groups of six families who work together to build one another's houses. The program also helps those families secure mortgages through the USDA. Sandy Albert of Community Concepts says that help is often needed.
We have some clients that have no credit, none at all, and a lot of traditional banks won't look at those because they don't have any history, and they will look at them. We've worked with many families that aren't ready because of some credit things. We help them fix that credit, and then they can apply when they're ready.
The program is looking for families in Androscoggin, Cumberland, Franklin, Kennebec, and Oxford counties to sign up. The program is expected to provide homes for 30 families. And boosting the creative economy might sound like an unusual way to help lift a country out of recession, but it was exactly what President Franklin D. Roosevelt was doing 80 years ago. As part of the Works Progress Administration, the huge stimulus package that formed the backbone of the New Deal, thousands of artists were put on the payroll to help lift America out of the Great Depression. New England filmmaker Michael McLaris tackles the subject in his latest documentary, the first to deal exclusively with this issue. The film makes its main debut tonight in Portland. Tom Porter has more.
Nobody wants you when you're down and out. Nobody needs you without.
At the height of the Great Depression in 1933, more than 12 million Americans were out of work. The unemployment rate was more than 25%. As concerns grew that the U.S. might be heading towards a revolution, President Roosevelt's priority was to put Americans back to work, including artists. As part of the New Deal, nearly $30 million went into the pockets of visual artists, actors, writers, and musicians like blues singer Juanita Hall, heard here singing one of the anthems of the Depression.
Nobody wants you when you're down and out. Nobody wants you when you're down and out.
Michael McLaris's latest film, Enough to Live On, examines this bold initiative by the Roosevelt administration. The title is a quote from one of the artists employed by the federal government, William de Kooning, who went on to become a world-renowned expressionist painter. But in Depression-era America, Kooning's circumstances were modest, and McLaris says the artist was grateful for the opportunity to be paid a plumber's wage to create his work.
William de Kooning, in fact, was painting houses when he took advantage of the federal art project funding. And he in fact, is the derivation of the quotation, enough to live on. He literally said, the WPA gave me enough to live on.
McLaris says de Kooning was one of a number of future artistic legends kept in work by the WPA during the 1930s.
And it's doubtful that their work would have prospered as much as it did, Tom, eventually, without this public funding that sustained them in their 20s and 30s. I mean, Jackson Pollock was painting neckties when he was pulled into the WPA ranks. He was doing that for a living.
That'd be worth a few dollars now,
wouldn't it? You think? Yeah.
More than 7,000 artists were put to work creating more than 25,000 works of art giant murals, paintings, sculptures, prints, many of which can still be seen today. Maglaris says there was pushback from some in Congress to the idea of injecting all this money into a sector where the returns were largely intangible. Wouldn't we be better off giving these people a pick and shovel and putting them to work in the labor force, they said? The response of the Roosevelt administration, says Maglaris, was that these people will be more effective going back to work doing what they know how to do.
So imagine, for example, putting writers back to work so that they can write the 50-State Guide to America, which is the Federal Writers Project. Imagine putting painters back to work so that you can walk in to more than 5,000 post offices in the United States, including here in Maine, and see works of art. So there was a real belief that if we all collaborate in that effort, we pull ourselves out of the depression and we make our society stronger.
Is it possible to quantify or address to what extent this project did help bring America out of depression? I mean, how can someone making a painting help restart the economy? It's not like building a factory, is it?
No, excellent question. And like all arts considerations, there's a soft answer I'm going to give you, and it's not a very good one, which is that we are all enhanced as individual citizens. Our lives are enhanced, and the collective body of who we are as American citizens in our culture is enhanced when the arts flourish. I can't quantify that value, but I know it's true.
And then there's the so-called hard answer, says Maglaris, which focuses on the practical importance of keeping America's artists busy.
What we did was we prevented anarchy. And Franklin Roosevelt realized something very important, as many writers did at the time. We came perilously close to losing our democracy.
Those creative people could be very troublesome if not kept employed.
As Erica right. Doss, Professor Doss, says in this film, you want those people off the streets. You want them doing something with their minds and their talents. And FDR was no fool. He wanted them off the streets, too, and he wanted them gainfully employed.
Enough to live on. The Arts of the WPA was made in Maine and will premiere here tonight at USM's Portland campus at 7 p.m. You can hear more from that interview with filmmaker Michael Maglaris at news.mpbn.net, where you can also see some examples of New Deal artwork. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter. Nobody wants you when you're down and
And that's the news on This Day in Maine, Thursday, October 8th, 2015. Our theme music was composed by Robert Holt. Thanks to our news leaders, Keith Shortall and Susan Sharon, and to A.J. Higgins, Patty White, Tom Porter, Ed Morin, and Nora Flaherty for their contributions. We'd like to hear from you. You can let us know what you think about the program by emailing us at tdim@mpbn.net. I'm Barbara Caritti. For all of us here at MPBN News, thanks for listening.